Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We had a very interesting webinar yesterday under the banner of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. It took a look at a development that has not gotten nearly the attention that it warrants, namely, the appearance, providentially really, of evidence that the Chinese communists have put into place in Central California a facility that, well, best case, was a kind of toxic waste dump. Worst case, was a laboratory that could be used for manufacturing biological warfare agents, not too far from a very, very important U.S. Navy facility, which, if attacked with biological weapons, could profoundly compromise the combat capability of our Pacific Fleet. A man who was featured prominently in that webinar and has been, I'm proud to say, in much of the work of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, is one of its members. His name is Dr. Stephen Hatfill. He has contributed mightily to, among other things, a book we call the Team B3 report entitled "The CCP is at War with America." He has a very distinguished record, more degrees than you can shake a stick at, a medical doctor by training, but most importantly for this purpose, one of our country's preeminent experts on biological warfare, both the offensive kind and what we have to do to defend against it. He was instrumental in helping our Team B3 assess and conclude rightly, that the origins of the COVID-19 virus was not some wet market in Wuhan, but in fact, the Wuhan Institute of Virology Biological Warfare Laboratory of the People's Liberation Army. We wanted to catch up with Steve and sort of take stock on some of the most important highlights of yesterday's webinar, which, as is true of all of them, you can find for free at presentdangerchina.org. I once again strongly commend it to you. Dr. Hatfill, thank you for finding a few minutes. It's so appreciated that you make yourself available for these kinds of conversations. And thank you for joining us once again at Securing America.
It's good to see you, Frank.
So you characterized in the course of this webinar this facility as one that may or may not have been anything more than some kind of scheme that the Chinese had to do some test production, not very effectively, as seems, but nonetheless, not necessarily a threat to us in the form of biological warfare, but one that could become a threat in very short order. Walk us through what we know about this facility, sir, and whether that's in fact a reasonable takeaway from what we do know.
Well, I had a look at the Fresno warrant to go into the property, and I only had four pictures to go on. A bit of a confusing thing.
Could I just interrupt you, sir, for just a little bit of level setting? This is a warehouse in a city called Reedley, California, pretty much smack dab in the middle of the state. Not too far, though, from an important naval station closer to the coast, as I understand it. But this is a building that was supposedly unoccupied and local zoning authorities tumbled onto the fact that it actually had something going on inside it, which brings us to your point, sir. Pictures of what exactly?
There was a level C animal facility in one of the rooms with apparently humanized mice. These are very expensive mice. They cost a lot. They've been genetically engineered to express receptors in the human airway.
Why would one do that to mice?
For gain of function experiments.
Gain of function meaning, in this case, trying to demonstrate that if you give a virus certain attributes, it will become an affliction for humans. Is that the idea?
But, you know, there was no, I didn't see, in the picture, I didn't see any advanced air handling. It would have been a, you know, very unsafe facility if you were trying to do something like that. It looked to me like this company was registered in Nevada, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And it kind of, everything was in boxes. There's lots of document boxes. There's lots of equipment that's wrapped up. Some of it looked fairly expensive. A number of freezers, some of which had gone off, looked like perhaps fetal calf serum in there. There was a workbench we looked at. It looked more like a crack cocaine, little homemade thing there than anything. I mean, you couldn't do any serious biological research in there. Not safely.
But conceivably, you could manufacture stuff if you don't particularly care about safety.
We don't know.
Toxic.
We don't know what's in the boxes of equipment.
They've been described as incubators as well as all of this refrigeration and freezer equipment.
Incubators are a little more explicit. Apparently, they had some pathogens there. I don't know if they were stored in liquid nitrogen or in the, you need special minus 70 freezers to maintain this stuff.
And when you say pathogen, sir, as I understand it, there were some 20 different infectious diseases that were
identified. All human pathogens, including herpes virus, strain type 1 and type 5.
So this doesn't sound as though it's just developing, you know, test equipment, do you think? Is there at least some interest in more nasty business?
Would appear? The whole thing is very odd.
And again, one of the other pieces of this that is important to just be clear about is that apparently they have traced the company registered in Nevada to China.
Well, Singapore.
Chinese nationals or
Chinese nationals, Singapore, and then strange nobody's home type offices in China. So
anyhow, that
I don't know if this is a couple scam artists trying to make lateral flow assays. We had a lot of that.
And then what's a lateral flow assay, sir?
It's like a pregnancy test kit, where you look for antibodies in the individual if they've contracted COVID-19 like 2 weeks previously or so. Very inaccurate. The market was, United States was flooded with these things. Some 200 Chinese companies trying to sell actually useless tests.
But these were tests that were intended to demonstrate that you had contracted the disease that they sent our way
in the past,
SARS-CoV-2 and that sort of thing. And so we're gonna have to take a very short break here, Dr. Stephen Hatfill. When we come back, I want to talk with you about the inherent capabilities that such a facility might have to create in our country something very, very dangerous indeed. We'll talk with Dr. Hatfill about that and much more. Stay tuned for the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A select House committee on the Chinese Communist Party has announced a significant breakthrough in the CCP's decades-long unrestricted warfare against America. The panel will investigate two companies that help our mortal enemy weaponize U.S. investors' money against them and the rest of our country. Following important testimony recently by our colleague Roger Robinson, the committee's bipartisan leadership declared that, quote, as a direct result of decisions made by BlackRock and MSCI, these Americans are now unwittingly funding PRC companies that develop and build weapons for the People's Liberation Army, exacerbating an already significant national security threat and undermining American values, unquote. Our Committee on the Present Danger China has long called for an end to such enabling of history's greatest existential threat to freedom and the firing of those responsible among the CCP-captured elites, especially BlackRock's Larry Fink. Let it begin. This is Frank Afton. Welcome back, and a special welcome to our guest, Dr. Stephen Hatfill, one of the most distinguished scientists and medical doctors in our country, I believe, most especially for his knowledge and, well, experience with the whole phenomenon of biological warfare. And Steve, you have described it seems like a ticking time bomb, among other things, with very nasty stuff in it that, under the wrong circumstances could have caused problems, at least locally. But you mentioned in the course of the program yesterday, our webinar of the Committee on the Present Danger China, available at presentdangerchina.org, that the nature of such facilities, if you can call it that, and the equipment in it, is that they're inherently dual use. Yes. And that if somebody wishes to apply them to not just a commercial test strip manufacturing thing, but to manufacturing biological weapons, they could conceivably be used for that purpose and in fairly short order. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of dual use technology. There's a lot of options for spreading a pathogen. Mm. Not a great
option. Including those mice, right?
It's very possibly.
Yeah. And one of the things that you also said that really caught my ear was that in the nature of biological agents, the more fresh they are,
yes,
the more lethal they typically can be. So if you want to inflict maximum casualties with such stuff, you'd like to have it close at hand to the targets reasonably quickly after it's been produced, right?
A lot of this stuff doesn't store very well. Mm. The liquid agents store very poorly to where they have to be refiltered if you're going to aerosolize it. The dry agents, the particle size is built into the powder, but again, outside of a couple agents, the shelf life is fairly short.
Yeah. So if the Chinese Communist Party was interested in engaging in biological warfare against the United States, perhaps without much in the way of fingerprints as to how they insinuated it here. We saw them do it through human-to-human transmission from China in the recent unpleasantness of that COVID pandemic. Yeah. This could conceivably be a means of putting themselves in that line of work. Is that a reasonable statement?
Having a local cluster, a local outbreak, is always very suspicious, and it's usually easy to track this down to case zero. Mm. But we've seen these Chinese facilities all over the country. Levy County in Florida, they were trying to put in a Chinese company in California, but they were trying to put a primate facility in, a monkey facility.
One in which they would be doing research on how primates respond
we assume so, or raising them. We're not really sure what the whole thing was, but Fortunately, this was blocked for zoning, but they had spent a lot of money buying the land.
Well, they're doing a lot of that for sure. But when you say these facilities are all over the place, that's really the question that comes to mind is, are there facilities that we would, if we saw this kind of gear in it, have reason to believe is at least available for that kind of biological warfare activity?
What we need to know right now is, where did they get these agents, especially the herpes viruses? And they had a range of bacteria and viral agents. Usually this is obtained through the American Type Culture Collection. And the requirements are very strict. The paperwork is adequate. And they don't just mail stuff to you.
So there's a paper trail somewhere, you would expect. If in fact it came out of the American
base. If they can't trace these agents back, then we have a problem.
Yeah. Well, and that's really the question.
Yeah.
Sir, do we, in your professional judgment, do we have a problem? This particular facility has now been obviously uncovered, and all of the nasty stuff in it, as we're told.
Everything seemed to still be in boxes there.
Yeah.
And look, we've got units that are highly trained to exploit these type of facilities and get to the bottom of things. So if nothing else, this is very good practice for them.
Well, it's a dress rehearsal for sure. The question is, and one of our other very distinguished colleagues and contributors to this program, as well as our webinars, is another Committee on the Present Danger China member, Charles Samfattas, former intelligence officer. And he was very, very skeptical, as I read it, about how good our counterintelligence is in monitoring these kinds of places that, as you say, they may not be like this exactly, but they may lend themselves to this kind of purpose that the Chinese have put into research facilities or into manufacturing facilities or other kinds of locations around our country.
There's some things in place, Frank. You know, if I started ordering 100-gallon fermenters, somebody's going to be knocking on my door. But
because that is a key piece of equipment.
That is a key dual use thing. What would I want with a 100-gallon fermenter?
Right. If you wanted a smaller quantity, sir,
Is
it possible to manufacture this stuff and then brew it to larger use?
It's possible.
Or if really what you're interested in is just having, as you say, clusters of these outbreaks.
This would be the thing. This would be a prelude to war. The penalties for being caught doing this obviously are, you know, this is extremely severe.
Well, I'd like to think so. It's, you know, the thing that's been stunning to me, sir, really is how little attention this seems to have gotten beyond kind of the local officials. Now, I assume that all the people you're talking about are pouring over it.
Everybody and their brother was in that facility within, you know, a day or so.
Well, but I mean, in terms of public attention and media coverage and all that, it's not been so much. And to the extent that, again, this could be a prelude to war, this could be one of the things that...
Here's how something like this would work, Frank.
Yes, sir.
If we're putting on our bad guy helmet, our thinking cap of bad guys, facilities near significant strategic military bases. The one closest to this factory apparently is where the carrier aircraft, the F-18s, this is where they're housed.
Or the Pacific Fleet.
Yeah, when the carrier deploys and gets out to sea, they fly out of this base and land on the carrier, and they're housed there, and they sail to where they're going. So pilots would live in the area. technicians, maintenance.
Right.
And
other mortals as well, of course.
You wanted to generate an aerosol cloud over that area under ideal meteorological conditions. And if you knew what you were doing, you could cause some havoc.
Yeah.
And the type of this thing would be like before, a preemptive thing.
Yeah.
A preemptive before Taiwan.
Strike elsewhere. Yeah. Dr. Hatfield, we are out of time. There's so much more to talk to you about, but thank you for this really important insight and for your contribution to the webinar as well. Come back to us soon, if you would, sir, with updates. God bless you. Be right back with more right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and it's my privilege to say we are joined by a man I've come to admire tremendously, both for his, well, clarity and his energy and enterprise in trying to bring what he's clear about to the attention of those here in the United States, as well as in his native state of Israel and elsewhere, about the challenge that the Israeli people and government are facing from Palestinian terrorists determined to destroy their country. And that includes not just the Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and other garden variety jihadist enterprises, but also the Palestinian Authority, the putative partner for peace for Israel, that is supposedly the good guys in the Palestinian community, to the point where our military and other police institutions in this country and others elsewhere around the world have been training the Palestinian Authority's personnel to maintain security. Itamar Marcus is the name of our guest. He is the founder and driving force behind a marvelous organization, Palestinian Media Watch, and it is a tremendous resource, particularly on matters involving, as I say, the threats from the Palestinian quarter, official and not official, and we're anxious to catch up with him about some recent developments in that space. Itamar, welcome back to Securing America, sir. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Always great to be with you.
So you were talking about evidence that you've developed that the Palestinian Authority is now making less and less of a secret, that even people that have been trained to be part of their security forces, ostensibly helping the Israelis maintain peace and prevent terrorism, actually have sideline jobs as terrorists. Is that right?
It's absolutely true. And the people who are saying it are the Palestinian Authority themselves. It's the Fatah leadership themselves. In fact, they're not just saying it, they're actually bragging about it. There was an interview recently with a senior official who gave the numbers, and he talked about the very, very large number, I forget the exact percentage, of all the terrorists who have been arrested in the last year. I think it was over 50% of them, he said, were actually members of Fatah. Many of them were members of the security services. In one of the articles, they talked about one of the terrorists who was killed, and they said he was a member of the security services by day, and he was a fighter by night. So they don't even hide that they're doing this. And I have to make one more point here that's critical. People talk about the security cooperation and about the positive side of the security cooperation. Now, what is the positive side? The positive side is that occasionally when the Palestinian Authority knows about Hamas or Islamic Jihad terrorists who are planning an attack on Israel, or if they know about an organization that they're forming, they will notify Israel. And then Israel will go in, will get them before the attack, and they'll go in and they'll destroy the infrastructure they're creating. Now, this is good for Israel, but why is the Palestinian Authority doing this? They're not doing it to help Israel. They're doing it to help themselves. Hamas and Islamic Jihad, both of them would like to take over Judea and Samaria, West Bank, the same way they did in Gaza. And if not for Israel, they would have succeeded already. So the security cooperation from the Palestinian Authority perspective is for their own benefit. It's not for the benefit of Israel. And you will not find examples of Fatah or Palestinian Authority policemen who are being squealed on by the PA and being notified to Israel. It's the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad who they see as a threat.
It's a hearty tradition in the Middle East that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And if you can get your friend, in this case, to kill your enemy, all the better, right? You know, I'm sure there's an Arab word that's equivalent to the Hebrew word chutzpah, but the increasing, well, I can only describe it as chutzpah, maybe contempt is a better word for it, that the Palestinian Authority clearly has for not just Israelis who are invested in this idea that, you know, they are a partner for peace and they're a force for good and they're helping keep order and all the rest of it, but also the United States government, which is in fact funding still under the Biden administration, the PA and its security forces and so on. I mean, this is so much in your face and in your grill that it's hard to describe it as, I guess, anything other than contempt. What do you think?
It's definitely contempt. Part of the challenge here, and this is the mistake in Israeli and American policy, as far as I'm concerned, they are fearful of the Palestinian Authority, in fact, collapsing, and that Hamas would take over in the West Bank. If the Palestinian Authority were left by itself, as I just said, they would actually have collapsed, but by Israel and the international community supporting the Palestinian Authority, they are supporting a terror organization. And we've been doing this since the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. Now you'd think after all of these years, after 30 years, try something new, try to find a different leadership. There are people in the Palestinian areas who loathe their leadership, who realize that their leadership is corrupt and they're basically terrorists. Find those people. Quietly support them, give them, and then when the Palestinian Authority collapses, as it should, those other people could possibly take over and replace the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority for 30 years has been leading terror against Israel, and they will continue to do it for another 30 years if they continue to be funded by the United States.
You know, it raises the question, Itamar, whether the other possibility, which is more likely, let's face it, that one of the other of these groups, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, if there's a dime's worth of difference between them, I'm not sure, but let's just say there is. If either of them were actually to take over in the West Bank and operate there with all of the latitude that running the place involves, as we've seen in Gaza over the years, presumably the Israeli response to it would be to crush what's being done. They'd have to. I mean, it would be a festering sore, but at least it would be clear that what you're dealing with is terrorists, as opposed to this sort of canard that you've got people that you can work with who are terrorists, in fact, right?
You're completely right, Frank. Israel will have a completely free hand to fight Hamas terror. We will have much less terror. if Hamas were ruling the West Bank. And I would say something else. Right now, Israel has a security wall, which we have essentially put around the Israeli areas. And we've left the bulk of the West Bank area C, which is really under Israeli jurisdiction. We've left that on the other side of the wall. I think were Hamas and Islamic Jihad or either of them to take over the Palestinian Authority, what Israel would then have to do is to create a different barrier and put the Palestinian cities behind the barrier the same way as Gaza is behind the barrier. And that would be about a massive, massive drop in Palestinian terror.
You would also be reviled for being an apartheid state, I'm assuming, if you were to do that. But seems like you're being reviled that way already.
We wouldn't be an apartheid state because what we're doing is putting them behind their own walls and saying, "Here, you can rule your own future right now. We're not a part of you. You make your own elections, have your own democracy. You do it yourselves." Judea and Samaria, Area C, under international law, is still Israeli jurisdiction, and it will remain that way forever if Hamas ever takes over.
Yeah. Let me ask you quickly about one other aspect of this, Itamar. You've been reporting on the extent to which we have now seen increasing anti-Semitism, very overtly emanating from the Palestinian Authority as well. What are the manifestations of that and the implications?
The Palestinian Authority needs anti-Semitism because, in fact, their whole identity is dependent on anti-Semitism. The Palestinian Authority claims that they have a 5,000-year-old history in the land and that Israel has no history in the land of Israel. They claim that all the Bible stories and all the incredible evidence and extra-biblical evidence is all false. Israel was never here. Then they have to tell their people, why would Jews have come to move to Israel if they have no history? And their answer to their people is, Jews are so evil everywhere in the world that the local populations just wanted, were desperate to get rid of their Jews. Mahmoud Abbas himself was interviewed on television, made a speech, and he said that the Jews were massacred from the 11th century through the Holocaust. He said, why did this happen? The Jews brought it on themselves because of their social role, the banks, the usury, and other things. Abbas said the Holocaust the Jews brought on themselves because of their behavior. So the Palestinian Authority says the international community, in order to get rid of their Jews, stole Palestine and created the state of Israel. Therefore, Israel has no right to exist. The Palestinian Authority needs this anti-Semitism to literally explain to its people why Israel has no right to exist.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think it has to be acknowledged that whether, again, you're dealing with the Sharia supremacists of the Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad stripe, or for that matter, that of the Palestinian Authority, they have baked into their sort of ideological DNA, if you will, Sharia's teachings that the Jews are, you know, apes and pigs and other, you know, horrifically anti-Semitic, you know, tribes. I appreciate your insights into all of this, Itamar, as well as keeping us abreast of what is developing in terms of the, well, metastasizing problem in the Palestinian quarter. Keep it up, my friend, at Palestinian Media Watch, and come back to us with updates soon, if you would. I'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A select House committee on the Chinese Communist Party has announced a significant breakthrough in the CCP's decades-long unrestricted warfare against America. The panel will investigate two companies that help our mortal enemy weaponize U.S. investors' money against them and the rest of our country. following important testimony recently by our colleague Roger Robinson. The committee's bipartisan leadership declared that, quote, as a direct result of decisions made by BlackRock and MSCI, these Americans are now unwittingly funding PRC companies that develop and build weapons for the People's Liberation Army, exacerbating an already significant national security threat and undermining American values, unquote. Our Committee on the Present Danger of China has long called for an end to such enabling of history's greatest existential threat to freedom and the firing of those responsible among the CCP-captured elites, especially BlackRock's Larry Fink. Let it begin. This is Frank Afton. We're back, and I'm ecstatic to say we have one of the women that I admire most in the whole world with us to talk a bit about the work she is doing tirelessly on behalf of our men and women in uniform. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of an indispensable organization, the Center for Military Readiness. You can follow her work there at cmrlink.org. And you can also follow her here with some regularity, I'm pleased to say, because she is updating us with regularity, I guess, for the various purposes, but mostly to help us understand, well, the Marxist effort to fundamentally transform the only military we have. And worse yet, to do it at a time when it is more urgent, arguably, than ever, that it be in fighting trim. And that is not the case at the moment. Elaine Donnelly, thank you for joining us, as always, and for the hard work that you do tirelessly on behalf of our servicemen and women. God bless you.
Thank you.
I want to start by talking about two things that are going on at the moment. One is the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the annual effort the Congress makes to set personnel ceilings and compensation and so on, but also policy in a lot of other areas. And there's been a very active back and forth going on, particularly between the House and the Senate now, about what's euphemistically called the woke agenda. I think of it as a cultural Marxist takedown myself, but talk a little bit about what's going on there, and then we'll talk about a very important nomination that bears on all of this as well.
Well, we're about in the third quarter of the football game, because what we have now is two versions of the National Defense Authorization Act, one from the House, very conservative, one from the Senate that omitted many of the things, but not everything, that the House put in their bill. And now that there is a pause, and the staff will work on reconciling the two versions of the NDAA for 2024, next year. And it's going to be interesting what happens in the fall, because the most contentious issues will be battled about or batted about in the very high level of the Armed Services Committees. And some of the really good amendments will make it in. We don't know which ones, but not all of them will make it in. So
amendments, these are the ones that made the House bill more conservative.
Right.
And give us some examples of the kinds of issues that are being addressed in those amendments.
Oh, please to do that. The article we just posted on our website, it's quite long. It's longer than usual because there are so many of them. Back in January, the Center for Military Readiness put out 8 issues that the Congress should deal with. We called it the challenge to Congress. Well, they dealt with all 8 of those issues and 4 more. And most of those were dealt with also on the Senate side, but not all. Now, the issues involved, number one, meritocracy in the military. The Supreme Court said that private education, higher education, may not discriminate on the basis of race. but it did not apply to the service academies. They were not a party to the case. So we are against discrimination. We want it to end at the service academies. There are amendments on both sides to say that race should not be a factor, but the administration is opposing these measures because they want to continue discriminating. So the two versions, there's nuances.
Well, again, that, if I may, that's a prime example of this fundamental transformation. You,
yes.
I mean, you can't imagine moving us from a system that rewards performance, especially in combat, into one in which people are being assigned to promotions or jobs on the basis of what? Quotas?
Yes, quotas, racial considerations being paramount. This is a corruption of what has always stood, what our military stood for, meritocracy, non-discrimination, recognition of merit. And we're seeing it in the appointments too. The next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Brown, his qualifications, he is totally committed to some other things that the House has come out against, diversity, equity, inclusion programs that are divisive, that do advocate discrimination based on race. Also critical race theory. The House has come out against that. The kinds of instructions that teach even military kids, the children of military service people, that the United States is evil and racist, our founding fathers were. They've got specific legislation that spells out that is wrong. The administration, though, wants that legislation defeated. They want critical race theory, and they have appointed a general to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is fully committed to that agenda.
I want to come back to that because this is such an important nomination. But in addition, Elaine, as you know, one of the things that they've been doing to enforce not just the CRT critical race theory training, but also kind of the implementation of it and the DEI agenda, as it's called, is they've been putting these political commissars in effect in things down to the unit level, I believe. Is that right? And how is that faring on the Hill? Well,
they're called Chief Diversity Officers or CDOs. They are political officers. They have a say on who gets promoted and who doesn't. And you don't get promoted if you don't buy into the full DEI, diversity, anti-extremism agenda. Both the House and Senate have measures to cut them back. Actually, I take that back. On the Senate side, there was an attempt to follow the lead of the House in eliminating these chief diversity officers. But that did not succeed in the Senate's bill. But in conference, the House version could prevail. It all depends on what happens.
And this is really such a key point. Having worked myself on the Senate Armed Services Committee a long time ago, those conferences are hugely important. And unfortunately, I think increasingly what's happened is they have been engineered by the staff without really the participation of the members.
And well, I think on issues like, for instance, transgenderism, the House has an amendment that did pass narrowly. It would end the transgender policies, the most extreme policies of the Biden administration, in effect returned to the nuanced policy that Trump had. It was not a ban on transgenders, as you know. It was about gender dysphoria.
And hold the thought, Elaine. We have to come right back. We'll be right back with more with Elaine Donnelly right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back, and a special welcome to Elaine Donnelly, who I had to very vociferously interrupt mid-thought as she was talking about some of the different positions that have been taken between the United States Senate and the House of Representatives in connection with their competing versions of the National Defense Authorization Act. And Elaine, you were laying out for us a number of very important policy initiatives. Talk about the agenda to accommodate transgender individuals in the United States military and how this is being seen on Capitol Hill at the moment.
Well, something very interesting happened. For the first time, a senator got on the record the experience of a constituent, a young woman in boot camp in his home state, and she said that she was forced to share showers with biological men, physically intact men. And this was a result, of course, of the transgender policy that the administration has taken to extremes. And on the House side, they passed an amendment to stop this sort of thing, to end the surgeries that are involved with attempting to change the sex of a person from a man to a woman or vice versa. Well, that's, you can't do that. There is zero success for such operations. But all of the corollary policies that violate women's privacy, this was an issue on the House side, and they did put legislation to stop it. On the Senate side, though, they wouldn't even bring it up. So who knows what will happen in conference? But this is an issue that's beginning to get more apparent in the military, and it's about time. Because I suspect a lot of bad things are happening like that.
Well, and Elaine, over the years, you have been, I think, an incredibly effective advocate for those in uniform who have been, you know, either involved in or blamed about sexual misconduct in the military. And great lengths have been gone to create various reporting arrangements and complaints, oversight, and all the rest of it. And yet, at the same time, we're having the United States military now creating conditions in which that is guaranteed to happen. And I just can't figure out how do they square this particular circle?
Well, if a man approaches a woman in the shower and he's naked and fully physically intact, that is sexual harassment unless he gets some bureaucrat to say, well, I'm really a woman. Then all of a sudden, she is supposed to get used to the idea of biological men in the showers. Now, it is so ludicrous. It's hard to believe that this
it's the showers, and I think it was Senator Mike Rounds who asked the question about his constituent, and he said it was in her bunk space as well as in the showers. I mean, this is lunacy, and the idea that we're spending any of our limited defense dollars trying to engineer these changes, whether they're successful or not, one can debate, but they're not consistent with good order and discipline. That's for sure.
People are Elaine pushing Donnelly, back hard.
Let me just come back to this issue of General Charles C.Q. Brown. This is a man who has been, I believe, appointed precisely because he has this woke, if you will, or cultural Marxist, more accurately, agenda in, you know, very much the forefront of his thinking about his leadership. And his leadership in the United States Air Force, of which he is the chief of staff, has been, I think, well, fairly disastrous, at least according to the work that our friends at the Heritage Foundation have done assessing the declining strength of the United States Air Force. Elaine, this man needs to be defeated. And the question is, 6 weeks from now, the Senate will come back and vote on his confirmation. As things stand now, he will surely be approved. How important is it that senators be acquainted with the inadvisability of entrusting a man who's not done terribly well as the Air Force Chief of Staff to become in charge of the whole United States military?
Well, elections have consequences. He is the president's choice. To find the votes to defeat him would not be an easy thing to do. But Congress can still pass legislation that he, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, would have to implement, because that's what the military does. Civilians run the military. It's not the other way around. So the members of Congress really need to look seriously at the legislation that is pending, the National Defense Authorization Act of Congress. Congress has the constitutional responsibility, the power of the purse, the power of the Constitution. They need to use it. And the military needs to follow the orders of the elected representatives. This is the way our system is supposed to work. Now, it's going to be a big test to see if it will, because many institutions are under threat right now.
Yeah. Look, I'm under no illusion about the challenge here. The president's appointment is almost always deferred to, and in the case of, let's be clear, a black general officer, there's a very high likelihood that people will just try to defer and avoid any controversy. But the reality is, you cannot vote for General C.Q. Brown to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff without, as you do so, voting to endorse the policies he espouses.
Right.
It's just that simple. Right. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, no, no, I'm really more concerned, as I think most Americans are, about what we're doing to our armed forces, and yet behave in a manner that would actually compound that problem enormously. Because it's not just General Brown, of course, as you know, Elaine. It's people south of him in the food chain who are all going to be queuing off of what it took for him to get promoted and what it will take for them to get promoted.
Exactly.
This is,
and that's why,
absolutely unacceptable.
These racial quotas have got to stop. They are insidious. And the Supreme Court says they are unconstitutional. Those principles should be applied to our military. Just quickly, I know our time is short.
We've got 30 seconds.
Different versions, abortion and whether or not LGBT flags should run or should fly over bases. The House took a stand against both of those things. The Senate did the opposite. These issues need to be addressed seriously in the conference committee, drag shows as well. We have
so
social
much more.
Issues
Elaine,
that need to be
we will
resolved.
Be following it closely with your good help. And thank you for your leadership on all of this. And especially, I want to commend everybody, rejectgeneralbrown.org. Go there, tell your senators that's what you want them to do. God bless you, Elaine. Come back to us soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.